Neanderthals died out a long time ago. Or did they? Neanderthals are in fact extinct, but they do live on in our genes. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Scientists are discovering that even more of our DNA comes from Neanderthals. We'll talk about that with anthropologist Bob Franciscus this hour. Also, the Farm Bill finally at the finish line. Business weighs in on the Affordable Care Act. What towns at the start and the finish of RAGBRAI this year will have to offer the 10,000 riders. And one of the world's most significant and iconic modern masterpieces returns to Iowa. Can you name it? Buckle up for a news buzz after this news from NPR. We've arrived at Friday. It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How much Neanderthal is in your DNA? And we'll have a business weigh in on the Affordable Care Act in just a few moments, coming up in this first half hour of our program. But first, finally, the Farm Bill at the finish line. On Wednesday, the U.S. House passed a new five-year compromise farm bill. The bill now moves to the Senate for a vote. Here to tell us what's in this new farm bill, the result of a two-year-long legislative saga, the inimitable Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media's reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Amy.
Hi there, Ben.
Broadly speaking, describe this farm bill that's looks likely to pass.
Something for everyone without making anybody terribly happy. How's that for broad?
Okay. Hit some of the big points here.
Well, this is a bill that is expected to cost about $1 trillion over 10 years. It does save money compared to the policies that it replaces, and it doesn't cut food stamps nearly as much as the House Republicans had hoped, but does cut them twice as much as the Senate had hoped for. So there was a lot of compromise involved, and there will be some significant changes to how Iowa farmers receive farm subsidies, but they will continue to receive different sorts of subsidies.
Total estimated cost over 10 years, $1 trillion, and you've got savings of, what, $16 to $23 billion. Where are the savings coming from?
Well, there is that $8 billion in estimated savings from food stamps. There will be significant savings in conservation because the conservation title has been changed pretty significantly. And there are estimates that the new farm subsidy programs will also cost less than the old programs. But one of the reasons they don't have better figures on really what this farm bill will cost is that there are many more programs that are subject to changes in the market, whereas in the past, for example, the direct payments, which are now mm-hmm. gone, were a flat amount to farmers every year. Mm-hmm. And now what they get will depend somewhat on what they choose and also what happens to market prices.
What are you hearing about how farmers in Iowa and the Midwest are reacting to this farm bill?
It seems that the overall sentiment is that farmers are just happy to have a farm bill now. Now they can look at what they need to do, figure out what decisions they need to make, and get on with their planning. But there are some. I spoke with a farmer in Clear Lake earlier this week who are disappointed. They don't feel that the farm policies are going to do enough to help small and medium-sized farmers, and instead will continue to allow large operations to get bigger.
Mm-hmm. Talk about Iowa's congressional delegation. I know the Senate has yet to weigh in on this, but the House of Representatives, where are four representatives on board with this farm bill?
Well, Steve King had an amendment that he hoped to have in the bill that ultimately was not included. And again, with so many, there were things that the representatives liked and other things that they didn't like. But ultimately, I mean, far more the bill got through the House with a very decisive majority. So there wasn't there really wasn't any question about it this time.
There's an acronym here, COOL. What is that?
Yes, COOL refers to country of origin labeling. Those are the new stickers that you see on packages of meat that tell you where the animal was born, raised, and slaughtered. That's a requirement that's now been law for some time. Meat packers and processors have had to adjust to it, but they really object to it. So there was an effort late in this game by many of the major meatpacking organizations to pressure the conference committee to repeal the COOL requirement. That didn't happen. And so those big groups, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the National Pork Producers Council, and the Chicken Council are disappointed in this bill. And we're making some noises about trying to convince people, representatives, not to vote for it. But it doesn't seem that their argument has a lot of legs.
The Senate takes up this compromise bill on Monday. What did I read? That Senator Grassley is a no vote?
That's right. I mean, Senator Grassley likes to point out that he is a farmer. He really is a strong supporter of many aspects of agriculture and many aspects of this farm bill. The reason he's voting no is that an amendment that he introduced in the Senate and a representative from Nebraska introduced in the House, which passed with the original bills in both of those bodies, has been eliminated. That would have Senator Grassley's amendment would have capped the maximum amount that farmers could receive in federal support. And it would have made a more tight definition of what it means to be actively engaged as a farmer. Both things that he felt would have closed loopholes and prevented essentially off-site non-farmers from making money on the supports that are intended for people who are literally on the ground farming.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we have to wrap up, tell me, how does this affect food stamp recipients in Iowa, SNAP?
The food stamp program was cut significantly. Well, not significantly. There were cuts made to the food stamp program, but they have mostly to do with a particular manner in which certain states were defining eligibility in connection with heating assistance. Iowa was not participating in that strategy. And so what's being discussed in Iowa right now is that these cuts to food stamps should not have a big impact on food stamp recipients here in our state.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And finally, why did it take so long? 2 years, this saga. What broke the deadlock and why couldn't this have happened 2 years ago?
I think that the reason it didn't happen in 2012 really had to do with election year politics. What carried over into 2013 was this wide gulf within the Republican Party, particularly in the House. And finally, as the conference committee was trying to get its work done in November, December, and here in January, I think you saw a shift in the House leadership. John Boehner finally came on board with the need to get a farm bill passed, and there was a little bit more unification within House Republicans. And then, you know, as we saw with the Grassley Amendment, things became open to discussion that probably weren't even on the table for discussion when the conference committee first got started.
Harvest Public Media's reporter at Iowa Public Radio, Amy Mayer, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition. Let's talk a little bit about the Affordable Health Care Act. Over the past few months, we've heard a lot about individuals signing up for health care insurance under the new ACA. What do Iowa businesses think of it? That was the focus of a recent study by the University of Iowa Public Policy Center in collaboration with the Iowa Department of Public Health, the State Health Insurance Marketplace Interagency Workgroup on Healthcare Reform, and the UI College of Public Health. Here to tell us a little bit about what this study found, its lead author, Dan Shane, Assistant Professor of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Ben. Glad to be here.
First of all, what does the ACA have to offer businesses? We've heard so much about individuals. What's there for businesses?
Certainly. Well, it matters a lot how big the employer is in terms of how many employees. So for businesses that have more than 50 employees, the Affordable Care Act actually puts a mandate on that employer that they have to offer coverage to their employees or face potential penalties. Now, those penalties actually have been postponed until 2015, but that's what's looking ahead for large employers.
So the large employer has to actually look after this, and it's channeled. The employer is part of the health care providing.
That's correct. So they would have to offer coverage to their full-time employees or face a fairly sizable penalty.
Mm-hmm. And less than 50 employees?
Less than 50 employees, that mandate does not hold. And what the ACA had in mind for those smaller employers was typical or similar to the exchanges for individuals. So there's a small business health options program. That's the online marketplace for small businesses. The idea is that they could go shop for coverage for their employees, and they would have the same benefits that the individuals would have, that people couldn't be turned down for pre-existing conditions. There would be a mandated set of essential health benefits that would be part of all of these policies. So that now, what the Obama administration has done is actually postpone the online version of that. So small businesses cannot go online themselves and shop for coverage, or they couldn't during the open enrollment period. They actually have to go through a broker if they want to sign up for coverage at any time in 2014.
What did this study look at? And you were one of three investigators here, I believe. That's
correct. We were interested in understanding the breakdown between large and small employers. And of course, that 50 is that critical threshold. We wanted to understand what their overall knowledge about the Affordable Care Act, what the general sentiments, support, lack of support. And then we also wanted to understand whether businesses were whether they were equipped or whether they were interested in using an online marketplace. And what we found is that small businesses were much more skeptical in general than large businesses. They were less knowledgeable and more skeptical about the individual components, even components that were designed to specifically help small businesses. For example, the tax credits, up to 35% of the cost of the premiums of health insurance. Tax credits are available for some employers that are below 50 employees, at 50 or below employees, to help them pay for that for the first couple of years of the ACA. Businesses were fairly skeptical.
Did your survey give any indication of the origin of the skepticism? Was it perhaps the coloring of the individual rollout, the bungled rollout of that online?
It's certainly possible. Our survey was pretty much complete before the bungling of the online rollout. But I think in some sense, the way I look at it is, for small businesses, they may not have the time. We may have hit, you know, somebody who is the owner of the small business or somebody who is very important. They may not have time to digest everything that's going on. There's a lot of moving parts of the ACA. People that spend a lot of time studying it don't understand it fully. Whereas for a large business, we were likely talking to somebody who was in human resources, whose job might be to understand.
So it could be just the timeline is so far out there for a small business that they have to deal with things, decisions in the immediate future, and they just say, I'll take care of it when it's more pressing.
Absolutely. And the other thing we found is that they typically rely on insurance agents and brokers. I mean, they're outsourcing, and they really trust. I mean, when we asked who they trusted with information about insurance and the Affordable Care Act, by far the number one source was their insurance agent or their insurance broker.
Given the concerns that you've mentioned revealed by this study among businesses, any clues as to what action might ease these concerns? How can this study be used, the information you gained here, to better the situation for the coming new landscape here for businesses?
Certainly. I think one big question is, how might these online marketplaces for small businesses actually provide value? And we asked employers if they thought what's called employee choice would be useful. Employee choice is, instead of the employer selecting one healthcare plan, and that's everyone gets the same plan, each employee would get the same plan, these marketplaces would be designed such that the employer could just designate a specific contribution amount, and then employees could select from a range of plans that fit in under this larger umbrella. And employers were very positive in terms of their support for that. So that could be something that entices businesses to participate in the exchanges rather than, you know, just having all employees under one plan. So that's a possible way forward where businesses might benefit through the exchanges.
Small business owner listening right now, what deadlines do I have to pay attention to if I'm a small business owner listening?
Small business owners don't have any deadlines that they need to worry about in terms of providing employees coverage. They're still, if they want to enroll through the exchanges, they've got to contact a broker.
Okay, then those larger ones, 50 or above employees?
For 2014, they're in the clear. Those penalties don't kick in until 2015. That was an extension that the Obama administration decided on late
last
year.
So they can sit back on their heels right now for a little while longer, maybe inform themselves in the extra time?
Well, what large employers, somewhere around 95% plus, are already offering coverage to their employees. So they're pretty much already doing what they needed to be doing.
Dan Shane, Assistant Professor of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a news buzz edition of our program this Friday. Quick conversations about news items we didn't touch on earlier in the week. The human species known as Neanderthals died out a long, long time ago. Or did they? Well, in fact, they did become extinct. There are no Neanderthals among us. That is, unless you count that annoying office mate. But anyway, they do live on in us. You might call them Neanderthal leftovers. Scientists studying the human chromosomes say they've discovered a surprising amount of Neanderthal DNA in our genes. And these aren't just some random fragments. They help shape what we look like today, including our hair, our skin. Joining me now to discuss this discovery, a man we turn to when we talk about all things having to do with human origins, Robert Franciscus, professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Iowa. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you on the program again. So Neanderthal is an extinct species of human. How much of our DNA makeup comes from them?
Well, it depends on exactly how you quantify that. Prior to the studies that we're going to talk about today, we knew that about 1 to 3% of Neanderthal genes existed in non-African humans, and we've known that since about 2010 from some groundbreaking work that was done then. But since that time, we have greatly increased the number of human genomes that have been mapped. Since 2012, thousands of human genomes have been completely sequenced compared to the very small number that was used in those earlier studies. And what these studies are showing us, one of the studies in particular points out that if you use all of this information in all of these people, which allows you to look at many different parts of the genome, something like perhaps 20% of those genes may be Neanderthals, and that may be a bit of an underestimate.
Mm. So 20%, does that vary from person to person, or is that consistent across all of the people on the planet?
Right. That's a good question. It varies from person to person, and it's by taking these bits and pieces of individuals and aggregating them across areas of the genome that we get this larger number of 20%. And that's what's different about these studies compared to the earlier studies, which relied on very small numbers of individuals, mm-hmm. one person from each major geographic region, and also to make direct comparisons with Neanderthal DNA. One of the studies that we're talking about, which was just published on Wednesday, didn't even look at Neanderthal DNA directly. It looked at these genomes of modern humans and used a sophisticated algorithm to calculate which ones would be Neanderthal genes.
So what is the significance, Bob, of this latest discovery that we have many more chromosomes from Neanderthals than we thought?
Well, I think in some ways this might have been anticipated given the earlier studies. Perhaps, you know, the 20% or even higher, they suggested might be as much as 40% if they had, you know, if they had even larger samples to work with. For example, they used, in the Nature study, they used 1,004 living people, and in the Science Express study, they used 665 people, 379 Europeans and 286 East Asian individuals. And they argue that if they were to get like 1,000 from those, each of those major geographic regions, they might pump that number up even more. Yeah. But again, this is not that surprising. What is interesting is which genes they're finding are there that we can deduce came from Neanderthals, things like genes that seem to control keratin, which is a protein used in the production of skin cells and hair cells and, you know, the cells that make up our fingernails and toenails, for instance. And they go on to suggest, and I think this is where it gets a little speculative, that maybe this is related to the fact that Neanderthals were living in cold environments and that they may have had thicker hair or somehow, you know, tougher skin or something to deal with that kind of climate. And frankly, I'm a little bit, you know, take that with a little bit of grain of salt, just because we know that there's other evidence to suggest that Neanderthals, like other fossil hominins, had actually already lost their body hair. And we also have quite ample evidence of Neanderthals using clothing, fire, and a variety of other sort of technological mechanisms that would have been more logical in some ways than having, you know, huge amounts of body hair to keep them warm. However, it is interesting that we can identify those genes. But the other thing that's very interesting is what's missing from these genomes. So, for example, and this has, you know, generated a lot of interest, they found hardly any Neanderthal genes that were expressed in the testes of the modern human male samples. And also that the X chromosome was almost completely, you know, missing.
What does that? What do those things tell you?
Well, one way to explain that, the way they explain it, is this would occur if males who were the result of Neanderthal and modern human interbreeding, that those resulting males were sterile. And if they were sterile, the males then could not pass on their single Neanderthal X chromosome, suggesting, quite interestingly, that most Neanderthal DNA found in humans today was passed down from females and not males. So that gets into whole issues of, you know, who was actually mating and how did that work and why we have the loss of some of these interesting areas that should be there.
Mm-hmm. Does it tell us anything about why Neanderthals died out?
Well, yes. I mean, not in and of itself, but that kind of sterility means you have a population that is not going to be as viable as a population that doesn't have that particular problem with male sterility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yep.
There's another very interesting thing about this as well. The Science Express study suggested that there may have been multiple periods of interbreeding, which I found particularly interesting, because one of the ways to explain the earlier results from 2010 was that maybe the interbreeding had occurred earlier in evolution, perhaps, let's say, 100,000 years ago in Southwest Asia, long before Neanderthals and modern humans might have been encountering each other, let's say in Europe, for example. But this, the Science Express study, based, again, on looking at these very large modern-day genomes, suggests that there were more instances of interbreeding, perhaps, you know, around 60,000 years ago at one of the latest instances.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think many people will find interesting.
Before we have to say goodbye in just a moment, I want to ask you, you said that it can vary the amount of Neanderthal DNA we have in each of us. Can we now, or will we in the future, be able to determine, perhaps even by looking at someone or getting a genome, how much Neanderthal Bob Franciscus is or Ben Kiefer is?
Certainly. I think that's around the corner. I mean, the rate at which the technological ability to look at finer and finer details of the genome and do these comparisons, and the way in which the cost is coming down so rapidly,
yeah,
I think that's going to be widely available. And I promise you, I'll be one of the first in line
that. Will that be on your resume if you ever apply for a new job?
You may or may not want to include that information.
Bob Franciscus, professor in the Department of Anthropology at the UI. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Bob. We'll check in later.
Very good, Ben. Great to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye. And when NewsBuzz continues, we'll find out about one of the world's most significant and iconic modern masterpieces that is returning to Iowa. Can you name it? We'll find out after NewsBuzz returns. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. News Buzz on this Friday with quick conversations about some news items that we didn't get to earlier this week. The artist Jackson Pollock's mural, Iowa's most famous painting and one of the world's most significant and iconic modern masterpieces, is going to return to Iowa this summer. The return of the huge canvas comes after nearly 2 years of conservation work done by the J. Paul Getty Museum and the Getty Conservation Institute in Los Angeles. The newly restored painting will be on display at the Sioux City Arts Center beginning June 10th of this year, And a good long time it will be on display there until April 10th of 2015. If we remember, it was in June 2008 that mural and thousands of other pieces of art were removed from the former University of Iowa Art Building. That was when Iowa City was flooded by the Iowa River, flooded the arts campus and a lot of other buildings. Joining us now to talk about this famous painting, Sean O'Hara, the director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
For those who can't quite picture it, describe the work.
Well, it's really big.
It is.
It's about 20 feet wide and over 8 feet tall. It was meant to make an enormous splash, pardon the pun, because Peggy Guggenheim, who was the leading art collector, art patron at the time, felt that Jackson Pollock was going to be her greatest artist. And she had sponsored other artists, Rothko and the like, Seliger, but she thought that Jackson Pollock was the man of the era, and she wanted this piece to pronounce to the world that this was a great artist, and he has arrived.
Okay, so we were seeing this huge canvas, but what do we see on it?
Well, it's really the missing link, or perhaps even the beginning, the genesis of modern art. It is a lot of swirls, almost like people running across the canvas, but you don't really see any person, many, many colors, and then, of course, there is his signature splashing of paint that is beginning to appear, because this painting was painted in 1943, so it was really at the beginning of all of this.
And we have to place it in the context of the 1940s, don't we? Because unlike today, where we see a lot of abstract artwork, this was, what, something new?
Oh, it was completely new, and it was difficult for a lot of people. It's still difficult for a lot of people, I would say. Really, what it represented was, at least to a lot of people, it represented the freedom in America and the freedom in art. And you have to realize that this is also the beginning of the Cold War, so there were a battle of ideas at the time. And it just so happens that Iowa City was the epicenter for a lot of this debate, the direction of art, the direction of thinking and philosophy and writing and so on. And so this painting arrived as part of that debate because the University of Iowa's professors were seen as the most avant-garde department in a university art program, and so Peggy Guggenheim had a lot of admiration for the professors here, and so she gave a number of works, including mural.
Mm-hmm. Gave. This is without cost?
Without cost. In fact, the paperwork, which is kind of interesting, and it's on our website, shows a to-ing and fro-ing. I think they argued over the $40 shipping fee for so long that the shipping fee rose to close to $100 because they took so long to talk about it. And I think there were a number of possible heart attacks in the administration here when they talked about $100 for shipping a work of art. You know, they thought that was scandalous. But, of course, you know, it was all worth it, you know, it's all about education.
Now, I've asked other people connected with the Museum of Art about the estimated value of this work today, and they were rather cagey in giving me an answer. Are you going to be a cagey person when it
No, I'll be very direct. We don't know. Well, actually, it's, you know, the problem is that it has in the past been valued at over $100 million, and it goes up and down. The thing about being a museum and being a university is that we don't own things like art to, you know, to make a fast buck or to do something like that on it. We acquire these devices or these items in order to teach, and so, you know, as far as we're concerned, students at the university and people who visit us experience a unique educational and profound experience.
Now, before the flood in 2008, I had the good fortune and the chance to see mural many times in its space that it was in at the old University of Iowa Art Building. People would spend long periods of time gazing at it. What do you think about What have you thought about when you gaze at it? What do you see?
Well, let me put it this way. It's a very complicated painting, and it represents the beginning of the modern art movement in the world. I mean, it is Jackson Pollock's first commission. Jackson Pollock is possibly the greatest modern artist ever. And so, incidentally, he did come from an Iowa family, so I want to just put that plug in. But and so what I see, it's very complicated. It has taken me years. I do see a connection with photography at the time. I do see a connection with photographing movement and the blurriness of movement. So I think there is definitely a lot of movement. I know that Jackson Pollock referred to stampeding animals across the canvas. But at the same time, it's not figurative. There's nothing to look at. The revolutionary idea of Jackson Pollock's was that a painting, which is, you know, traditionally a rectangular canvas on a wall, suddenly became an experience and became an interactive piece of art. So I think that's kind of, you know, where I'm coming from, because it's so complicated and it has literally taken me years to come to terms with it.
Yeah. Well, what do you say to those who are not so versed in the background of this painting and in art history, who will look at it and say, give me a few buckets of colored paint and some brushes and I can splatter something on a huge canvas like that. And then afterwards I can make up what it might be looking like, swirling figures or horses.
Well, I would encourage them to do that then, because I think the world needs more great artists. So, the thing is that he did this first. And he did it. It's a bit like John Cage, writing his piece on silence. It's not that anyone can do it. Although this is more painterly than most. I mean, this is a very difficult painting.
It did take him a while to do this.
It is. I mean, this is very different from a lot of the other works. Although I would say the other works are harder than you think. And I think a lot of people who say anyone can do it are people who've never taken art. Now, it would be great if they did, and then they would be more informed about, you know, about their views on art. I think it's hard. Art is a very difficult field, and it requires study and knowledge. And for those who have taken it, I think they'll understand how important this is. It represents a piece of history and the beginning of America's domination of the art world, which is a kind of a big deal, you know. Yeah. And the connection, the direct connection with Iowa, is very interesting. And it also shows that Iowa is a sophisticated place, which particularly in the world of art, which is not necessarily the stereotype that we're led to believe.
Okay, Jackson Pollock's mural returning to Iowa to be at the Sioux City Art Center June 10th of this year until April 10th of 2015. And before we go, quickly, Sean, when will it find its way back to Iowa City?
Well, when we build a new museum, which will be very soon, because we're doing all the work we can to get that done.
Sean O'Harrell, the director of the University of Iowa Museum of Art, thanks for filling us in about this masterpiece, Jackson Pollock's mural.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Repeat after me. News Buzz. News Buzz. Can you hear how the endings of those two words are different? Can you feel the difference as you make the sounds? Can you picture what's going on inside your mouth when you say News Buzz? It all has to do with phonetics. That's the scientific study of speech sounds and how they're produced. And the University of Iowa phonetics website has become an incredibly popular teaching tool for teaching English as a second language. Now it's also available as a mobile app for Apple and Android. The new smartphone app allows users not only to hear but to see how to pronounce certain foreign language sounds. Jerry Moon is one of the developers of the original website, as well as one of the developers of the new app. He is a professor of communication sciences and disorders in the University of Iowa College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How does this new app work?
The new app is, as you mentioned, is available on Android and Apple, and it's a resource that allows individuals to look at all of the different sounds of English, to view an animation showing the position of articulators of structures in the oral cavity, the lips, the tongue, the jaw, and so on, which have to be positioned in a particular way in order for us to produce each of those individual speech sounds. And so it's really difficult if, you know, when as a speech language pathologist, if you're trying to help an individual who has trouble producing a given sound, it's really difficult to do at times because you can't see inside the mouth. And the same applies, I think, trying to help someone learn a second language, in English as a second language, for example. So being able to see inside the oral cavity, play an animation that shows where those structures are supposed to be, with a description of that as well, and then being able to listen to audio examples of that sound, I think just gives individuals a tool that helps them learn those specific speech sounds.
Mm-hmm. To be clear, the original website developed several years ago, it deals with not only English but Spanish and German. This new app is only for English, and it's really taken off for English as a second language. Can you tell us what sounds in the English language are most problematic? For example, like let's say an Asian person, a Chinese person learning English would typically have problems, most of the problems with English sounding what sounds?
Some of the different vowels, the difference, for example, between maybe E and I, which involves the structures, just minor adjustments in the structures inside the oral cavity, but that is not a sound distinction that a Chinese native language speaker would have in their inventory. And mm-hmm. So being able to even hear the difference would be difficult, and then being able to make those minor adjustments in the structures in the mouth to produce those two different sounds would be difficult. That would be one example.
Watching the animations on your website and the app, you really get an appreciation for what a complex sound-making instrument we humans have when we can see through it and see the animations. It's not just as easy as opening your mouth. It's complex.
It very much is. You have a number of different anatomical structures and a number of different muscles that all have to be whose actions all have to be coordinated in order to produce the acoustic output that we hear as an S versus an SH versus an F. And it is amazingly complex, and it's something that we just don't even think about. You don't, when, you know, as we're talking now, we're not really concentrating on, I have to put this structure here and this structure there. We just, that's the program that we work with.
Jerry Moon, professor of communication sciences and disorders at the University of Iowa College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. Thanks for explaining this, and congratulations on the success of your new app.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about it.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This year's RAGBRAI, the overnight towns, have been announced, and it tells us some important things about this year's route in 2014. It's a short ride, quite short, and quite flat, except for the final part of the ride. It's a northern route through the upper tier of the state, from the west, starting off in Rock Valley, through Okoboji, the Iowa Great Lakes area, Emmitsburg, Forest City, Mason City, Waverly, Independence, and finishing up on the Mississippi in Guttenberg. Well, let's talk to the mayors of the two towns that bookend the RAGBRAI route for 2014. The ride to take place July 20th through the 26th this year. Let's go to Rock Valley in Sioux County. It's a town of just over 3,000 residents along the Rock River, and it's the first time that Rock Valley has been an overnight town for RAGBRAI in its long history. The mayor of Rock Valley is Kevin Van Otterloo. Mayor Van Otterloo, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a couple things about your town.
We're a Dutch community up here in Sioux County, and we are extremely aggressive up here, and we are growing like mad. We're one of the fastest growing small cities in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So when this announcement came out, what happened in town? What was your reaction?
Well, I was in Des Moines at the announcement party, and our table erupted. We were pretty excited.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a lot of phone calls. People are really excited in town.
What does it mean being a RAGBRAI overnight town for a town the size of Rock Valley?
For us, it means we're going to get a lot of visitors to town that have never been up here, and we get to showcase what a beautiful city we have. You know, we have a river going right through us here, beautiful campground, beautiful recreation activities out here, and we feel we've got a great city we're really proud of.
Mm-hmm. You're a city of just over 3,000 residents. How are you going to handle these 10,000 riders and the support people that come along?
that's the logistic problem that we're dealing with, but we're going to have great volunteers up here. That's mm-hmm. the one thing we really pride ourselves in is all the people really come out and volunteer and are willing to offer their services. So, and the neighboring towns also are very good with that up in this area.
Have the phone, have you been hearing from other residents? Phone's been ringing off the hooks for RAGBRAI riders and the groups to find a place to hunker down for the night?
Yes, the phones have been ringing since about 9 o'clock Monday morning. And the emails are coming in. I know we've had phone calls from Nashville, Tennessee already, and so it's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. So why so long to get to Rock Valley in the over four decades of running RAGBRAI?
You know, I know we've been applying for the last 6 years. I'm not sure before that if we did or not. But we've been aggressively going after it for the last 6 years for sure. And we're pretty excited up here.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been applying for the past 6 years. Is this something like soliciting the powers that be at RAGBRAI, the vying for the right to be an overnight town on RAGBRAI, the way a city would want to be an Olympic city or something like that?
Oh, I don't think it's anything like that. We just send in an application, you know, and list the qualities of the town and if we can handle the green space and handle the campers and everything that's coming in.
Where will most of the riders be bedding down for the night in Rock Valley?
We do feel we're going to have our sports complex outside of town that is going to be pretty much loaded up, and it's right by the high school. It's got a walking trail between the two of them, and we've got some big areas out there. One of the things we do is we host the National Hot Rod Association tractor pull up here every year, and they've won awards every year with the track up here. So we're used to some big crowds, not this size, but you know, they get usually 5,000 to 6,000 people in town for that.
Mm-hmm. What do you estimate the economic impact will be on Rock Valley?
Well, from the last year's people talking, it sounded like there was going to be like $3 million worth of sales. So we're hoping to at least break even up here and make a little money, maybe.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Kevin Van Otterloo, Mayor of Rock Valley, Iowa, where RAGBRAI starts off this year. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you very much.
Well, 6 days later on RAGBRAI, after pedaling across the state from west to east and overnighting in Okoboji, Emmitsburg, Forest City, Mason City, Waverly, Independence, RAGBRAI riders will cruise up and down the hilly part of eastern Iowa into the town of Guttenberg in Clayton County on the Mississippi. Guttenberg is a river town with nearly 2,000 residents. Its mayor is Russ Lovin. Good afternoon to you, Russ.
Good afternoon. Glad to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Tell us a little bit about your community and what you'll be showcasing for the thousands of riders that are coming through in July.
Well, our main showcasing is our city, our beauty of the city. When they come in, particularly if they come in for the first time, I'm not sure which hill they're coming in on, but they got to come in on a hill pretty much to get here, except unless it's by the river. They'll see a beautiful place. It's Forbes magazine has it in the top 10 of beautiful places. So it's an awesome looking sight.
Mm-hmm. What sort of preparations do you anticipate for Guttenberg? Have you been a city on RAGBRAI's route before?
This will be the fifth time for Guttenberg.
Uh-huh.
This will be third time since I have lived here. 2005, I was involved in it at that time. City has a lot of experience at doing it, but, you know, during that period of time, it's not the same people doing it all, so
right.
It's like getting it all started all over again. So.
We just talked with the mayor of Rock Valley out in western Iowa. This is uh-huh. their first time doing it, so if they listen to this program, what would be the lessons you think that Guttenberg has learned from past experience? What advice would you give?
Well, one thing is to have get the best chairman of your advisory committee. Your committee is running the whole thing of volunteers, and get going. Get the best person you can there. And there's a lot of Des Moines Register does an excellent job of helping along and meeting with you and providing the manual and organizational ideas and that. And they got some requirements, of course, but is being extremely well organized.
So the riders will actually not overnight in Guttenberg, will they? Because that's the last stop.
Yeah, very few of them that stay, you know, that come on the route. A lot of them just get out of town as quick as they can. They, you know, they had a long ride and they're ready to go.
Especially but, after all the hills in eastern Iowa.
This route is I have never been on this road, but I've been in these towns. It's relatively flat all the way until you get over here. It's going to be some rugged hills, but they're awesome hills, so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Now, Gutenberg, as the last city on the stop, will be the, and along the Mississippi, it'll be placed for the traditional tire dipping of all the Ragbri riders. Do you have
one of the best, even though we're a small community for an in town, we have one of the best sites for them to dip their tires. We have a big marina area that has, on a typical weekend, we've got hundreds of fishermen there. So I don't know, we're going to keep them out of there or what we're going to do, but, you know, we keep that path open. And so they got a nice place to go and dip the tires. So.
Okay, Mayor Russ Lovin of Gutenberg, Iowa, congratulations on being selected once again for Ragbri, and good luck with those preparations.
Thank you very much.
Perhaps a little bit of a challenge to imagine a hot, and perhaps humid Ragbri ride in July at this time of year, especially with the snow coming in. We can put our imaginations to work. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Help from Jason Burns and Ames today. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.